This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Doug Hamilton is on medical leave. We are going to start today with a new book from photographer Wayne Goodmanson. It's called A Song for Leave. Wayne, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So it's named after your daughter, Leave.
Correct.
But also the word leave in Icelandic translates to life.
Correct.
So talk about the double meaning of this title, A Song for Leave, A Song for Life.
Well, I will. I read a book by Bruce Chatwin called Songlines, and in that book he traces the custom of the Aboriginal people who are nomadic and wandering around, and this is pre-written language. And to keep track of their travels, they would make a song. And the songs had to do with the landscape, of course, because they're recording their travels. So it's kind of an audio map, if you will, from this mountain to that river across this desert and so forth. But folded into that sort of factual map was things that happened to them, a birth, a death, a broken leg, hunger, whatever. So it's kind of a sense of place. Because it's about these people and their relationship to the land. Mm-hmm. And then the part that really struck me, the real poignant issue in there, was that they felt if the song wasn't sung, the land would die.
Yeah.
Which is absolutely wonderful because it means that it's then incumbent upon them to sing their song.
Mm-hmm.
And to keep alive their memories, their time on the planet, their sense of that place.
Mm-hmm.
And so early on, maybe when I was 6 years old, I would visit my grandparents' home in Mountain, North Dakota, and we would go up there. And a six-year-old is kind of this androgynous creature. I could be in the camp with the women at the farm or with the men. And,
mm-hmm.
And anyway, so I gravitated towards the male side. And after talking about the weather and new cars or farm machinery, they would start to recite the poetry of a man named Cowan Julius, who was known as Cowan, which is K-N in Icelandic. And so as a six-year-old, I thought, well, this is kind of interesting that these grown men would – take joy in reciting poetry about this guy. And they would say it in Icelandic first, and then many of the poems were translated to those of us who didn't know Icelandic. Hmm. And but they took just such great joy. And I remember thinking, you know, it'd be okay to be a man, you know, to recite no poetry, recite it, enjoy it. And so I became fascinated with this guy. And there was also he was an itinerant worker, as many people were, and he published his first book of poetry in 1920 in Icelandic in Winnipeg, because that was an Icelandic stronghold.
Mm-hmm.
And
there's a line, Winnipeg, Gimli, Mountain,
yeah,
right?
And Mineota, where Bill Holm is from, is
okay.
Another of those strongholds. And since 1920, he has never been out of print in the Icelandic language. So I was always fascinated with this guy. Who was the guy? What's the story about this guy who affected the community in that way? And I was telling Dennis Hamilton, a good friend of mine, who you know of, and
Doug's brother, if I'm not mistaken.
Doug's brother,
okay.
Exactly. And he saw, you got to call Bill Holm, who's a, you know, known poet and a character in many ways. And so I called up Bill and I said, my name's Wayne Goodmanson and I'm doing this project, kind of backed into it. And I said, it involves this guy named Cowan Julius. And Bill says, another expletive, Icelander. And then Bill launches into a poem in Icelandic by Cowan about the time Cowan visited Mineota. And because Mineota was dry then, he couldn't get a drink. And so he called the people from Mineota ugly people. And so it's like, you know, when you fish and you catch a big one. So
yeah.
The project on. So Bill and I were going to do this project on Cowan Julius.
Mm.
And so we did a lot of talking to old people and people my dad knew and my grandparents knew, et cetera, et cetera, and started to put together a picture of who Cowan was. And then we realized, because it's going to be my photography paired with Bill's translations of Cowan's poetry and some insights into who he was as a man. Mm-hmm. And at the core of this was how one culture revered him, i.e. the Icelanders, and kids grew up memorizing his poetry, not just with this group of men in Mountain but across the country, and how another community tolerated him because, as one woman said, he was something of a scallywag. So that was kind of – that was it. And so that's what in 1993 got me to Iceland. And so I found out where Cowan was from and made those photographs of the place. And whenever I travel, I'm always reading the books of the writers from there and the history of the place. And I came across a genealogical line of mine that went back to a man named Grímur Kamban, who was the first settler of the Faroe Islands in 1825.
And this goes back 20-plus generations.
Yeah, 29.
29, okay.
And so I said, well, I wonder where my people came from. So I set out to photograph as many ancestral landscapes as I could.
Hmm.
And so what the book is about, or the form that's worth noting, because it's not traditional chronology of these people.
Mm-hmm.
It's just kind of vignettes, and it's my photograph of this place paired with a diary-esque kind of entry. It talks about the wind, the weather, whatever,
mm-hmm.
how I found the place. And then the center part is kind of my sense of that place and maybe the person who lived there or the people that lived there. And what about the emigration experience? Mm-hmm. And what about – what was their life like and so forth? And so this thing is more – this book is more of my reaction to these places than it is some kind of spelling out my genealogy.
Mm. It starts with a poem about a funeral. And we've already established that leave translates to life, a song for life, a song for your daughter, and it starts with a funeral. What has just acknowledging that death is absolutely going to happen, how does that change how you approach living?
Well, very directly. I mean, it is carpe diem. I mean, you seize the day and get what you can and find meaning for who you are as a person and what makes you tick. And so I think it's looking back on how these people went about their business, who mm-hmm. they were, as seen through those landscapes. And I wanted to pass that on to my daughter. So I finished this thing probably 16, 17 years ago and put it away. I gave it to Leave. She was on an exchange program in France, and she was a junior in high school, and I gave it to her. And then that was it. And then she had, you know, the next generation appeared. So a little guy named Emil Goodmanson showed up, followed by Colette Goodmanson. So I dusted it off, not wanting to kind of add more chapters to this, but you know, the urge to kind of share something, you know, kind of remind her that it's her song now. So anyway, so yes, and then in cleaning it up a bit because there were some rough edges and some things didn't make sense, I showed it to a friend who runs the NDSU Press, Suzanne Kelly, and she said, well, maybe we should publish this. And then Tom Tamaro, an old friend, offered some good advice in addition to a blurb, and I rewrote the epigraphs for the six chapters to bring in more the writings of, Cowan Julius, for instance, or Haldur Laxness, the one Nobel Prize winner from Iceland, and Norse mythology, of course. And that's it. And so I was able to give a copy of this to Leave and two books that maybe in 30, 40, 50 years, Emil and Colette might find interesting. Not now.
We're visiting with photographer and writer Wayne Goodmanson. His latest book is called A Song for Leave. And Wayne, you talked about being able to trace your ancestors back 29 generations. And I noticed in the book that they are primarily living, you mentioned the Faroe Islands, and then one little corner of Iceland for 20-some generations. They're there in that one spot. And I want to compare that with your immediate family right now. You grew up in the Fargo-Moorhead area. Your wife is from England. Your daughter lives in France. And so just within this generational shift, you are representing three different countries across two different continents. And compare that with this lineage that goes back to one place.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a good point. It's a very good question. But I think of Grimur Kamban, who was the first – well. The Irish monks were there before, but they didn't have too many kids to stay on.
Yeah, and monks aren't known for that.
No, not their long suit. But he picked up his last name, which is a Celtic name, probably because of his time on the Isle of Man. So there's a mixed marriage, if you will, there. And he goes to the Faroe Islands, and his son and grandson were some of the first people to discover Iceland. So already that movement, you know, from – well, it probably originally came from southwest Norway.
Okay.
So from Norway to the Faroe Islands,
okay,
to the Isle of Man,
mm-hmm,
back to the Faroe Islands, then to the northeast corner of Iceland for about 1,000 years.
Yeah.
And then
do you think we can develop that same sense of place even now when it's so easy to just jet off to somewhere else?
I think so. I mean, a sense of place exists because you invest something in it. You have some perception. You know, you have some – and it might just be fleeting, but, you know, a moment, a rich moment lived makes a place. So, I mean, the world's just spinning faster. And so we're probably a product of that because you know, I was in the Navy on Guam, of all places, and traveled a bit there and did my student teaching in Copenhagen, met Jane there. We were married in England. We were on our way to Mexico. We stopped in Moorhead to teach. I taught a class at MSUM. Went to the Creative Arts Studio, back to MSUM. So kind of always on the move. And then leave goes to French camp and then studies in France. And majored in international relations. And so when she went to their second time during college, that she should have an international relationship shouldn't have come as a surprise. And she's not coming back to South Moorhead, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, my daughter moved to Brazil, and then I knew, okay, she's not coming back to Moorhead. I'm interested in a turn of phrase that you used, I think, in your very first answer, and it shows up in the book a couple of times. You say that you make a photograph or you make a picture. Other people would say that they take a photo or take a picture. What's the distinction between making a photo and taking a photo?
Well, it's a huge difference. You know, to take a photograph, you are literally taking something. But to make a photograph has to be a greater investment, perceptive investment. And as you know, I taught photography and
– to me, in fact.
Yeah, to you, in fact, and you survived. So it has to do with what that moment that you press the shutter button. I mean, if you compare painting to photography, in painting you make a mark, you step back, you look at it. You can go up, you can add something to that, you can erase it, you can paint over it, you can go. So, but photographs are born whole, and it's what you bring to that moment when you press the shutter button that makes it a photograph. And so it's that investment. It has to do with place so much too. I mean, you're investing in that place. So done well, it becomes a without getting too carried away, becomes a heightened experience.
Hmm.
And that's, I ended up taking a lot of photographs and I ended up making a few.
It's no easy feat to do this work in the winter in places like Iceland. There are a couple of good anecdotes in the story about times where you could almost not even get a shot off. And sometimes it was Iceland, sometimes it was a blizzard outside of Mountain, North Dakota. So just these moments of you're out there, you have every intention of making this photo, and then the weather says, well, hey, I'm the one in charge. But you still have to be present in this moment while sort of making sure that you survive the moment.
Yeah, I mean, it's serious stuff. As people who live where we live, blizzards are not to be trifled with. But the conditions are always changing. I always thought that if I shoot with a large format, that's a tripod and a 4x5 view camera where you
– Yeah, your equipment's large.
It's large and cumbersome. But still, I always thought, well, this will be easy. You put it on a tripod and you just sort of wait till the right moment appears. But it's just so ephemeral. It changes so quickly.
Mm.
So you have to be sort of hyper-tuned to what's in front of you. And I think that's where sort of the adrenaline gets going.
Mm.
And you see that moment. And sometimes they get away very quickly and you miss them. And so you just have to kind of be on your game. And you try to be non-literal and have a visceral response. So maybe something of that place, evokes something. And then you got it.
What tends to be the first thing you notice about a place?
I think after a while, and, I've been doing this for a long time, 50 years, you start to see in the shape of the format of the camera that you're using.
Mm-hmm.
So a 4x5
is
4
inches. I hear in sound
bites.
Yeah.
So you, in fact, as I'm sitting here, sometimes I'll close one eye because then you see the way a camera does. You don't have depth perception. And then the alignment is so precise because now your head, curiously enough, is next to the photograph behind you of Doug Hamilton and you.
Right.
And if I was to make it even more sort of interesting photograph, I would just sort of move. There's a sweet spot in all this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can generally sort of zero in, but it's not till I'm on the ground that then I do the tweaking up, down, left, and right because there's just one place where it's the best.
Right, and that sweet spot.
Yeah, so you're always hunting for that.
There is a moment in the book when you talk about visiting your grandparents in Mountain, and I think you're that androgynous 5 or 6-year-old. And there are these moments where I believe it was your grandpa, you guys would go in the car, break off, clutch in, and just coast down these long rural North Dakota roads. How far do you think we can go? Is that a metaphor for how you live your life trying to find those sweet spots?
I don't know. I don't know. It is a great – it's a great image for me because it says so much about that place and the family rituals that we would do. Mm-hmm. I think I'm more kind of – I take away the fun rituals because he was a funster and he would always say, come up with odd things like we might be sitting outside and he'd say, well – and he's talking to his grandkids now. How many pairs of socks do you think I have? And we go – come again, please. And they said, no, how many pairs?
Grandpas are weird sometimes.
We got a quarter on this. And so we'd all guess the number. And then we'd follow him into his bedroom, and he'd open up, and we'd count the socks, and someone would get a quarter or a candy bar. So, and coasting down was one of those rituals. And I took leave as an infant on her baptismal coast down the hill. Which is something. And a lot of families did it because it's on the west edge of the River Valley, the Pembina Escarpment.
Mm-hmm.
And that Schroeder's Hill is part of so many families' traditions, coasting down and finding out and how far do you think we can go.
In the book, you There's an essay and a picture where you talk about including an overexposed image. And I'm looking, like I'm thinking back to when you were my professor and how we were always aiming at getting that contrast perfect in that sweet spot. And someone who's published many books and has been in exhibits and museums the world over. And then you include an overexposed image. I just wonder, did it feel like a mistake? Was it something you had to sort of swallow and get over your pride? Or why include an image that I could not have handed in as a student to you?
Well, you could have. I just would
have gotten a bad grade.
You just got a bad grade. I think it's sort of paying homage to the quality of light, because it's just so it's a rarefied light in Iceland. There's so little pollution. You've got the sun. You've got the water. You've got this amazing light that it took some time getting used to. So I think it was just sort of saying, this is an amazing place visually. So it won. I took second place on that one.
The book is dedicated to your daughter, but there's also a mention in there of the lessons that you and your wife learned from a stillborn son. Putting together a book like this, decades after the kind of loss that will never leave you.
Well, that's one entry that I can't read out loud.
Yeah.
But I think in there, again, is this idea that fleeting moments can create place. And you know, when I use the word place, I'm talking about a sense of place, not just a legally recognized definition of a location. So that kind of had to be there. And this is four leaves, so it was a painful thing, but it had to be in.
The book is called A Song for Leave. It is the latest book from photographer, writer, and professor emeritus Wayne Goodmanson. Wayne has a show opening at the Rourke in Moorhead, Minnesota on September 12th. Wayne, thank you so much for your time and talent today.
Well, thanks. Good to be here. Good talking.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck and dedicated to producing reliable electricity. Basin Electric operates generation stations in North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, and Wyoming, including wind projects in North and South Dakota.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And joining me now from our Bismarck studio is root cellar Sue. Sue Balcom joins us once a week from her farm outside of Mandan, the root cellar's farm, to talk about food. Thank you, Sue.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now, you sent some topics, and this first topic is hummingbird. And I'm going to guess you don't want to talk about eating hummingbirds.
No, they aren't even big enough for an appetizer.
Yeah, I know,
let's
right?
face the facts.
Let's not eat them. But if you're talking eat a lot of sugar and bounce around from one beautiful thing to the next.
That'd be
me. I'm way ahead of you.
I love it. I never even put two and two together.
My husband is like, are you a hummingbird?
That's awesome. Because they are extraordinary. And we are fortunate enough to have one or two or three or four hummingbirds, never more than that, every year. And so we do feed them. However, the topic of hummingbirds came up at our house because my husband gave himself the David Attenberg Award. Now, your viewers probably...
Did he present himself with a statue? And...
Yeah, he was so proud of himself. David Attenborough, just for those people who don't
know.
There we go. That's what it is. He was down at the other end of the tunnel. We watched this PBS program all the time where, you know, he's an environmentalist and mm-hmm. he's watched the degradation of forests and oceans and things for so many years. You've just got to believe this guy, right? So he is an environmentalist. JC likes this kind of stuff. And so one of the things about the birds that we have, the hummingbirds and otherwise, is that I grow flowers inside my high tunnel, sunflowers and other flowers. And, you know, hummingbirds love color and nectar. And so there's this little tiny hummingbird and he's trapped inside this big high tunnel and he can't get out. And so I'm rolling down the sides and I'm saying, please help me. I don't know what to do. And the poor little thing had to been getting tired because we will talk about how busy they flap their they don't flap their wings. But so we're
wait,
like,
what are they doing?
They do their wings are done in like a figure eight, like they whip them around in a figure eight. And
that's
they're
cool.
So tiny, and they're friendly too. So if you start feeding them, and then you start, like, you can actually get them to drink out of your hands if you're patient enough. They're just so sweet. So we got this bird, and one time one got caught in there and it died, and I was heartbroken about that. And then one time some other bird got in there, and the cat got in there at the same time. And if you put two and two together, that did not end well for that bird either. However, we have this tool that we use that looks like a really wide hole. And so JC was going to like kind of shoo him out. And that didn't work, but he was holding it when he was standing at the other end of the tunnel. And this little thing lit on it, like just sat on the top of this tool. And JC walked him down the 90 feet to the door and let him out.
Love JC.
I know. Aww. And that's why he gave himself the David Attenborough Burger Award or whoever that guy
is. Attenborough
Award. And I thought, oh, let's talk about hummingbirds because this is the time of year that the birds, some of them, disappear. And I asked my husband already, I said, have the geese headed south yet? Because I really want it to stay nice for a little while longer. And he said no. And so the hummingbirds are also a migratory bird. And I did not know that because we have found their little teeny tiny nests in our trees. And by teeny tiny, these things are only about 2 inches long and weigh less than 2 grams. So, I mean, they're just and they're so slippery. They almost look like a fish sometimes. Their bodies are so fluid when they're flying. And naturally, do you have hummingbirds that come around your place?
We have had a few, when the apricot tree is in blossom in particular, but sometimes throughout the summer.
And they're iridescent. Like, beautiful little birds.
They
beat those wings about 80 times per second in a figure eight pattern, which means that they can helicopter. You know, like when I'm standing by the door and the bird comes at the same time every morning to the feeder, it'll stop and it'll kind of hover there. And I can hear the wings, so I know it's out there. And if I move at all, it'll flit away. But if I'm very still, it will actually stop and it will eat. And so they're just so much fun to watch and take photographs of.
Yeah, if you can get your focus.
That's right they fly away.
So are they pollinating your gardens?
Oh, absolutely. I'm positive. I've seen them go from flowers outside to flowers inside. The only thing that disturbs me this time of year with the little buggers is that the hornets are out. And they have just showed up within the past week or so at the farmer's market, too. And so anything sweet or, you know, sugary or red or whatever, the hornets are there right with the hummingbirds in the flower garden and their feeder, which I think makes them a natural enemy of the hummingbirds.
I think everything is a natural enemy of a hornet.
The hornets, yes.
However,
my advice would be to quit flapping around when you see them because that's what people do. And that's when they get bit. I'm like, just leave them alone. You panic. But anyway, hummingbirds, like, they are, in the spring, they fly thousands of miles northward. And so when somebody says, oh, you eat like a bird, it doesn't necessarily mean that you don't eat teeny tiny meals. It means that you're eating constantly.
All day. Yeah.
Yes. Because flying that far is definitely a trip. And so they come up here. They come up as far north as Alaska. And so we're kind of thrilled that we actually got this. And they're not the real, real colorful varieties that live up here. But we have seen ruby-throated hummingbirds up here once in a while. And I don't know if this is the same bird that keeps coming back or if it's different. But, they make round-trip migration flights of more than 1,600 kilometers, which is like almost 1,000 miles. And they have lots of energy, of course. And so when the wind blows, they're tiny, lightweight little whatever you'd call them. They're almost like an insect. You can hear their wings moving. But when the wind blows in the direction in which they're flying, they can travel 50 miles an hour.
What?
Yep. And sometimes they fly nonstop when the winds are right.
Like when you're only a couple of inches long.
I know. Can you imagine?
50 miles an hour is
if you hit something,
substantial.
That would be the end of that, wouldn't it? Like, oofta. Shoot.
Yeah.
So in order to maintain that kind of they have to eat a lot. And they do not like the cold, which is why they come and go. And so they actually can enter a hypothermic torpor state to survive.
Okay, what does that mean?
Well, that means that their like heart rate and metabolism would slow down and they would be, it's like if a human fell into the icy cold water and, everything kind of shut down.
Okay.
Or snakes, and bears, they kind of like slow their metabolism down. And everything so that they can survive without eating or moving for quite a while. Now, where do they hide is what I want to know. I've never seen them in the trees, but I know they nest in the trees. But get a load of this. Their hearts. And when I say slow down their hearts, they seriously have to be in charge of that because their heart beats 1,260 beats a minute. And they take 250 breaths a minute.
Wow.
So think about what we could do if we could like rev up our metabolism like that, huh? Maybe we could fly too. I don't know.
Right, yeah. We're a bit bigger than a couple inches. So what would be the math there on going 50 miles? Yeah, we're not going to do that.
Nope. Go ahead.
So when they're going into that state, how much does that heart rate slow? Do you know?
I do not know. And I suppose it would probably depend on the temperature, actually. Because they stop about every 15 minutes and rest a little bit. And they really like certain trees, birch trees and butterfly bushes. And they also might rest on your hummingbird feeder if you don't have a cat that peers out the window at them constantly, we really try to protect them from that cat. So,
when you feed other birds, a lot of times there is a seed mix and you put it out there. But hummingbirds, I feel like the only thing I have ever heard about hummingbirds is it's just sugar water. And then there's a little bit of an argument of sugar water with dye or sugar water in a container that is already colored. Do they eat anything besides sugar water and like what they're getting out of the plant?
And they get that same kind of nectar out of flowers.
Huh.
Also. And so do they, usually like our hummingbird feeder is amber colored bottle. I suppose that protects the sugar water from the sun a little bit.
Mm.
And then there's tiny little bit of red on the tips of where they feed. They have those tubular little mouths that go in there. And, of course, like I said, them stinking wasps are around there all the time. Mm-hmm. The hummingbirds do like red, though. Like, they must be able to determine the red color from other colors.
Mm-hmm.
Because
it's an easy one to see.
They have, right. And they have special cones in their eyes that the different shades of red show up. But I've seen them on other colored flowers. But they do. I do every year get a little red nail polish and paint the center of the little decorative area where they can eat from red because I really want them to come back. Now, this is the thing. The water, the nectar, does not have to be red. In fact, I would discourage you from coloring that water at all. And it's a very simple formula. If you take One cup of water and a quarter cup of sugar, and you boil it till the sugar is completely dissolved, and then cool that off because you don't want to put it in there while it's hot. Mm-hmm. I actually make the nectar and keep it in the refrigerator so it's nice and cool. And then we just fill that feeder whenever, and they eat like, oh, I shouldn't say that. They eat like pigs.
They eat like hummingbirds.
The little birds, they eat like pigs. Oh, no. Oh, shoot. They eat some insects, too. Like, they must be really teeny tiny insects. But, yeah, don't tint that water. And definitely hang a feeder out because I seem to think this spring that there's less birds in our yard or less – there's less noise in the morning than there used to be, you know, when the birds wake up and they all start singing. I don't believe that the hummingbirds make any noise except for the hum of their wings. And they do like flowers, so definitely, you know, put a feeder out, but you can also expect them to visit your flower garden.
What are some of the best flowers for?
Red.
Okay, that was easy.
Anything. They have a heightened sensitivity to brightly hued red and yellow flowers. So I've seen them on my zinnias, and let's see, I've got moonflowers, which are white. You know, I've seen them down there. I've seen them down amongst the catmint in my herb garden and stuff. So I think they just kind of move around a little bit. But bee balm, which I plant every year, as much bee balm as I can possibly mm-hmm. get away with without JC finding out, because that and foxglove are really good pollinator attractors. And bee balm grows so easy, you know, like.
Yeah, even I can grow bee balm.
Yeah, or borage. Borage grows really easy, and mm-hmm. that's really a good pollinator flower, too. So, but there are others if you look them up online. And these little turkeys mate between March and July, so I would imagine they'd be extra hungry early in the year. So get those flower pots out on your deck, like geraniums. People put those out in May, and then you can bring them in if it's going to freeze. So
for someone like you who is a farmer's market producer, you want to be growing a number of vegetables and maybe some fruit. I'm just wondering, do you spread out those flowers specifically throughout the garden so that the hummingbirds are flying
everywhere,
including over the plants that you are trying to propagate for selling?
Yep. Every time I plant my garden, if there is one bare spot of dirt before I'm done, that gets borage or zinnias or sunflowers or something like that in there. And that not only gets them moving from one group of flowers to the next, it confuses some of the pests that come looking for, like, monocropping, which is planting one huge crop in one place. It's like serving dinner to pests. They're like, wow, check that out. And then they dive right in. Yeah. Whereas if I mix up flowers and herbs, basil and things like that, basil in my peppers, things like that to kind of help. It's companion planting and it's diversification at the same time. And it's kind of like when I walk into my high tunnel in the morning, I almost can't bring myself to leave because it's like the Garden of Eden. It's just a big tangled mass of whatever. You know, there's flowers here and sunflowers there and there's insects here. Although the grasshoppers are out right now, not my favorite. So I carry a clipper and cut those suckers in half.
Yeah, I was hiking on the Matahe Trail over Labor Day, and it was almost like you could pretend you were summoning the grasshoppers to go do your bidding. Like you would just take a couple steps and there would just be swarms of them.
Let's digress for just 1 minute,
You and me?
Oh, my gosh. This is so cool. Like I did these interviews with these German-Russian ladies, and one of the things that they always had in the fields during harvest was grasshoppers. Mm-hmm. And these kids would, like this one gal, if I could think of her name. Anyway, it was so funny with her German accent. She goes, yeah, we'd pick those grasshoppers up and we'd go, spit tobacco. And I'm like, what? And she's like, if you take two grasshoppers and you hold them in your fingers with their wings locked and put them next to each other, They'll fight. Like, they're carnivorous. I actually saw three of them beating up on some granddaddy of a grasshopper, and then they were fighting amongst themselves. Mm. And they'll eat the heads off the off of each other, and they'll spit this stuff out of their mouths. And it's really quite entertaining. Oh,
I would love to see you host a nature documentary, honestly.
We made this little video, and we put it on YouTube, and everybody's like, you've got to be kidding me. And I'm like, it was so much fun.
I see Sue's getting into her own sugar water here.
Yes. Okay, breathe.
Slow the heart rate down. Be like the hummingbird.
So I suppose it's kind of mean that I do cut them in half, but they have sticky feet. You know, when you're hiking and they jump on you, they're kind of clingy.
Yeah.
I don't like that. So anyway, what I said earlier about hummingbirds not, you know, vocalizing in the morning like the other birds do, they do when they make a little chittering humming sound, when they're mating. So they must move their wings in a little bit different way to make a mating call. So I'll bet there's some like amazing films about slowed down hummingbirds, right?
Yeah, Nature on PBS has a hummingbird program.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
And they have some amazing footage.
And like
really
most
slowed down and macro lens.
Yeah, and then they're in the sun and they're just beautiful colored. And of course, the males get to be better colored than the females. But however, in every good society, the female is the one who selects the nest site,
right?
Based on view, I'm sure. And she builds a nest, and they're about the size of a thimble. And it takes a week for them to build. And they use a little moss and a little lichen, some plant down. They actually collect spider silk. Is that not cool? I suppose
that cool.
Gives it a little strength.
Yeah.
Cotton fibers, you know, whatever you can find out there blowing around in the wind.
I like to point out to my husband that a great number of bird species, the males wear colorful clothing and they know how to dance to try to attract their mate. And I'm like, I'm just saying. You could have more than 17 gray t-shirts.
Hey, yeah, I know what you're saying. And then there's the dancing thing, you know?
Yeah. Do hummingbirds do that? Do they have a mating dance?
You know what? I don't know, but I'm going to try to find that out. Oh, and then they hatch. We forgot. After they mate they build a nest and all that good stuff, they have these really teeny tiny little eggs. They hatch in 14 days. And the young fledge in about 3 weeks. And I don't think.
How big are they when they're born?
That's what I was going to say. I can't even imagine. They can't be much bigger than a grasshopper or a hornet, you know?
Yeah.
And guess what? The female also asks the male to leave after they mate so that she can take care of the eggs and feed the young. And the young get the insects. So I imagine it's like the same old thing where the birds chew up the insects and.
How long does the average hummingbird live?
Well, if they're not caught by my cat, 3 to 6 years. Okay. But they did find the oldest living hummingbird to be 9 years old. So
whoa.
That's pretty cool. But that how would they know that, you know?
Well, the oldest one on record.
So they must have followed it around. It'd be impossible to tag them, don't you think?
I don't know how you would do that.
Put a little ring on their finger and it would keep them weighted down, huh?
Yeah, right.
And just like us, my dear, the female hummingbird has a longer lifespan than the male does by several years.
For what we have to put up with.
Yeah, you're hatching those stinking eggs for one.
Now, you mentioned if the cats don't get the hummingbirds, they can live 3-6 years. What other kinds of things go after hummingbirds?
One of my least favorite birds of late are blue jays. Blue jays will attack hummingbirds and other birds, and they're noisy little suckers. But the praying mantis will also attack a hummingbird if the opportunity is there. Yeah, can you imagine that? Praying mantis, they're about to be about the same size, right? And occasionally, if the hummingbird is sipping nectar from a pond lily, there might be an occasion where a fish would go, "Oh, look at the colorful lure."
Oh.
And that would be the end of that bird. So that would be
I never thought about that.
Sad, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I suppose their big defense mechanism is that they can get away so fast.
Right, right.
But
and they are tiny,
that,
so they could hide quite easily, I'm thinking, too. But as you can tell, I'm totally in love with my hummingbirds, and I was so happy we were able to save that one.
Oh, good. Oh. Well, we check in with Sue Balcom once a week. Thank you, Sue.
Hey, thanks, Ashley.
The Heritage Education Commission, in partnership with Moorhead Community Education, presents the 45th Annual Family History Workshop online, Saturday, September 18th, from 8:45 a.m. to 4:15 p.m. The featured presenter, Jill N. Crandall, professional genealogist and educator, will present four live-streamed sessions. The workshop also offers 15 virtual on-demand sessions by expert presenters for all skill levels, novice to professional. Information and registration at heritageed.com.
When you hear the fanfare, you know it's time for another movie review with our in-house movie critic, Matt O'Lean. Matt, thanks as always.
You bet.
And you have seen the 747 millionth Marvel movie, right? Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings. Did I get that right?
You got it right. And this is a new film that's going to kind of take us to new characters in the Marvel cinematic universe because – you know, the previous characters, Iron Man is dead, Black Widow is dead, and Captain America has been retired. So we have a new group of characters coming in, and Shang-Chi is one of the main ones. This was a Marvel Comics character, and essentially, without giving too much plot away, I will just say he is a young Asian man living in San Francisco who's forced to confront his past when drawn into his father's Ten Rings organization. That's about all you need to know. I will say I really like this movie.
Yeah.
It does not feel like a Marvel movie. It is a Marvel movie, of course, but you're drawn to the characters immediately. I knew nothing about these comic book characters going into this movie, and within half hour, 45 minutes, I was into the characters, drawn into the world of Shang-Chi and how he has to confront the powers that he has. And confront his father as well.
So a lot of good backstory.
And they really did. The director, Destin Daniel Cretton, did a really good job of setting up the backstory. Simu Lau plays Shang-Chi. He is a Canadian actor and stuntman. Very good in this role. We see his excellent stunt work, martial arts skills put to good use. The fight choreography in this film, Ashley, is so amazing. It's really well done. There's a lot of martial arts going on, a lot of fighting that Shang-Chi has to confront people with his father's Ten Rings organization. Awkwafina, one of my favorite young comedian actresses, plays Katie. She plays Shang-Chi's buddy. They park cars in San Francisco, and she has no clue about his past. And that provides some comic moments. Awkwafina is so funny, but she's also very good in dramatic roles like The Farewell. So she's great in this as well. Tony Leung, who's a legendary Hong Kong actor, he plays his father, Wen Wu. He's the head of the Ten Rings organization. He gives a really subtle, nuanced performance as kind of this nuanced villain. It's not just a normal kind of one-note type of villain. There's a lot of nuance to his character, a lot of turmoil that he's gone through that explains why he's doing what he does. But he gives a great performance. Mengge Zhang plays Shang-Chi's sister, Zhao Zhaoling. She also is very good at martial arts, and she's great in the movie as well. And we get the return of Ben Kingsley. If people remember Iron Man 3, Ben Kingsley, Oscar winner, played the Mandarin. And he is hilarious in this movie. He again plays the actor Trevor Slattery, who's being kind of kept in the Ten Rings compound as sort of a court jester who does Shakespearean monologues. He's really funny. That's what he does. It is hilarious.
Strange.
So again, I knew nothing about these characters, but I was drawn into them immediately. There's a lot of Chinese folklore going on in this as well. There's some good kind of female empowerment messages going on as well that are well done. I just really like this a lot. It's a quick 2 hours and 12 minutes. the characters are going to go from here, because they're all going to have, you know, further films in the Marvel universe. This is, again, it feels like a combination of an action film, Asian Chinese folklore, and a Marvel film all in one.
Wow. You mentioned a couple of times martial arts, and even that the lead actor is also a stuntman. And mm-hmm. usually, you know, you have the stuntman doing all the stunts, and then you have the actor being the face. Is this a new, like, do you have to do this to be in the Marvel comic movies, where you have to be fit, but also worry about that liability of what if you accidentally get kicked in the face?
Yeah, all the Marvel actors and actresses have looked like they can handle themselves. Mm. They really have. And Simu Liu does not disappoint as Shang-Chi. You know, he's not a physically imposing man on screen, but he's obviously buff. He's in shape. He's got great skills. You know, some of the best parts of this movie are fairly early on when Awkwafina realizes through something that happens on a bus that her buddy Shang-Chi has some weird powers, and she's like, what is going on? Who are you?
Where'd you come from?
And she has to go on his little journey to find the Ten Rings and find his father, and she just happily goes along with him, even though she has
like
no
do.
Superpowers whatsoever, except she's really, really smart and really funny. But that's a great plot device. Mm. She's hilarious. Ben Kingsley's hilarious. But Simu Liu is an actor as well, so he's very good in the part. Again, what Marvel does so well, Ashley, is the casting. They have just nailed the casting, from Robert Downey as Iron Man through Chris Evans as Captain America, Chris Hemsworth as Thor, and now finding Simu Liu as Shang-Chi. And of course, there's going to be more movies coming, as there always are when new Marvel characters are introduced. So it was a huge box office hit over Labor Day. I wasn't sure. Phenomenal. I mean, it's the highest grossing weekend kind of since COVID.
Wow.
of a film. So it really caught the attention of people. And what's amazing, Ashley, is these characters are new on screen. So there wasn't any kind of previous franchise except Marvel to build off of. And if you miss on these characters and you miss on the casting, the Marvel fans will turn against you, and they did not. They came out, and it's going to be a runaway hit.
All right. Well, I said that there were 700 million Marvel films, which is slightly hyperbolic. But I do have a list in front of me of the 25 movies in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I have them in chronological order and in alphabetical order. Which one do you want to tackle?
Wow. You're going to do this. Okay. I'm going to tackle them in terms of the characters. Can I do it that way?
Yeah.
Iron Man 1, 2, and 3.
Okay.
Captain America. Captain America Winter Soldier. Captain America Civil War.
I can't even keep up with you.
Thor. Thor Ragnarok. And there's a middle Thor film.
There's a middle Thor film.
Oh.
Dark World.
The Dark World of Thor, yes. Black Widow's got her own movie. Mm-hmm. Ant-Man 1, Ant-Man 2. Mm-hmm. I don't think Ant-Man was called Ant-Man 2, but
Ant-Man and the Wasp.
And the Wasp,
yeah.
Right? Captain Marvel, Doctor Strange.
Uh-huh. Okay, that's enough. You know plenty of these, but there are, several more. All right, we've been to the movies with Matt O'Lane.
That's it for this weekend edition of Main Street. Coming up on Monday on the show, a look at the new cookbook, Midwest Mediterranean. Until then, enjoy the rest of your weekend.